I'm calling to order the steering committee meeting for the Five County AOG, and the time is 1:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 12, 2023. Let's go through introductions, if you all wouldn't mind saying your name of the people that are in here in person, starting with Mayor.
Mayor Torgerson from Esquimalt City.
Jerry Tater, Garfield County Commissioner.
Wade Hollington, Deer County Commissioner.
Your name?
You knew that was coming. Washington County.
Ryder Fowles, Beaver County School Board.
Mayor Nolan Davis, Milford City.
Burke Staley, Washington County School Board.
Celeste Myers, Kane County Commission.
Paul Cousins, Sun County Commission, and we have a special place in the minutes for Gil's comments.
Lauren Lewis, Iron County School Board.
Lyle Golding, Mayor of Orderville.
Gary Zabriskie of Five County.
And then virtually, we have Lisa Livingston from Kane County School Board. That's it that we have for the board members virtually, isn't that right, Gary?
Yes. Lisa, can you unmute and tell us if you can hear us okay?
I can hear you. Thanks.
Great.
Thanks. Okay.
Thanks, Lisa. Wonderful. And I've asked Cody to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance today.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our next item is to review and approve the draft minutes from March 8th, 2023. And I'll entertain a motion for that.
Second.
Great, wonderful. There's a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Great. Any opposed? Motion carries. All right, we're going to learn about the CDBG program, the Community Development Block Grant. I guess it's a public hearing. So what I'm going to do...
Cody's going to explain a few things first before you open the public hearing. Cody, can you
go
up front there?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then refer him to that last page of their packet.
All right. Thanks, Cody.
So, with the CDBG program, the Five County AOG, we have two applications, and they're basically to administer the CDBG program for the area and to do some planning assistance for the communities in the area. One of them is for $50,000, one of them is for $48,000. And that's basically what they are. And the scope you can find, like Gary said, in the back there. So basically the purpose of this is to hold a public hearing. We're required to hold a public hearing to get public comments on our applications, which we approved last month in the rating and ranking committee.
Okay. So I'll now open the public hearing. And are there any comments?
And we did advertise that on the public meeting notice website as well, that the public could call in and participate electronically. So we might want to see if I don't see anybody. Let me see. Maybe ask if there's anybody online that's here for the public
hearing. If you are online for the public comment period for the CDBG grant, could you please raise your hand electronically? Okay. Seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close the public comment period. Thank you. Is that satisfied?
That's done.
All right. Now we've got something really special. The Utah legislators are going to give us a report. I think this is about 5 minutes each.
I gave them 10 minutes. That's if they want to speak that long. They're politicians, so be careful what you ask for. So.
We're all politicians.
I know.
Have a public servant.
Hi, Mayor.
Did I need to print my...
you want to there?
Excuse me.
Shall we go in order of here?
Oh,
yes,
Come up this corner like here, then I can get it so people at home can see.
I'll sit by you.
Anyway, I'm Rex Schiff, Representative Schiff. I just finished up my fifth session. I represent District 71. It's Cedar City, most of Iron County. Basically includes Canaryville, Cedar City, Parowan, Paragona, Bryan Head, Summit, those areas. Representative Bob Rick covers the rest of Iron County. He gets the more of the land part of Iron County. I've got more of the population. So anyway, this is a good session. I think I'm just going to read. There's a lot of things. If it was just me, the only legislator reporting, I would talk about a lot of other things. But I'm going to mainly focus on some of the legislation that I was involved in. Is probably what you want to know. Doesn't appear on paper that I was involved in this legislation, but we passed a transgender protection bill for young kids. I've been working on this for about 4 years. I had a bill this session as well. Senator Kennedy, we had some strategy that we worked on to start a bill both in the Senate and in the House. My bill was a little bit stronger in some areas than his, and as interestingly enough, when they went to the House committee on the same day, the Senate had already passed his bill and had their committee meeting. Mine just got to the committee, House committee. Mine failed, but his was presented right after mine, and his passed. Okay. And then when it came to the House floor, we made a couple of significant amendments to it. We did a substitute and included a couple of significant things we felt made it more, it made it stronger and kind of how most of the body felt it should be. So we got some protection for our young kids. It's been my concern for the last several years that a lot of these kids that have this gender dysphoria, we are damaging healthy bodies because statistics out there show that 80 to 90% of these kids were just fine in their biological sex by the time they got to adulthood through puberty and adulthood. And so we're damaging a lot of kids, and there's a lot of detransitioners come back. So that was one. Also, I passed had an adoption bill, adoption tax credit bill. It's focused towards lower income people. The cost of adoption is so high you're talking $40,000-$50,000 anymore if you go through an agency. I had to cut it way back because of the large fiscal note. Leadership came and said, hey, we like your bill, but it's too big of a fiscal note to do what I wanted to do, so I cut it back to where, and what it does is it allocates $3,500 for an adoption, and if you are, and that's a non-refundable tax credit if your income is over a certain level. If you're under that level, it can be a refundable tax credit. So that was part of the tax bill, the $800 million tax bill that passed. My portion was about $2.5 million is what the fiscal note was on that. So I was also the House sponsor on an ESG bill. I'm sure most people here are familiar with ESG. There were four bills that were passed. Actually, before the start of the session, there was about 37, I think they said, bill files open on ESG stuff. And so we met as kind of an ad hoc group with the senators and the House members, and we kind of put them into about four categories, and we read four different bills to push back on the federal administration on this ESG stuff that's it's hurting our fossil fuel, our mining and fossil fuel extraction work. And so I think we got to a pretty good place. I'm sure there's going to be more coming on that. I see Colin shaking his head, yeah, back there. And so so that was a key issue. All these bills passed. And as you've probably heard, our state treasurer, Marlo Oaks, has been really outspoken on this and is trying to get help around other treasurers around the country to help out on pushing back on this issue. So we want to just do business, you know, and let the private market take care of it. And we don't need, you know, banks, talking to the banking industry, they just want to do banking. You know, they don't want to worry about what your ESG score is. If you can pay the loan back, if you've got the collateral, it's okay, then we'll do the loan. So.
Go woke, go broke, right?
Pardon me?
Go woke, go broke, like a Silicon Valley bank.
Yeah, there you go. So, okay, any questions?
So with the ESG stuff, where are we at with that right now? I mean, I know Marlo kind of started that fight or pushback. Where's that at?
Well, we passed some bills. For example, my bill was focused on procurement, state procurement. So if any state, the state or any of its subdivisions, okay, if they're dealing with an entity, a bank that has policies, kind of a boycott on ESG type, you know, against you, like if you're a fossil fuel company, the state will not do any business with you. So that affects all subdivisions of the state. And there are some of the others that had to do with social stuff and so forth, and I can't speak real well to those, but I just know it's a position we're taking as a legislature to push back on this. I know Treasurer Oaks, they had a situation where S&P Global was going to come in and rate the state, you know, for a bond rating and stuff. And our federal delegation, as well as all of our state leadership and the government, wrote a big letter, pushback, said, we don't want you coming around to do a rating on ESG stuff. We won't adhere to it, type thing. So.
One more question.
Okay.
So I read an article yesterday where it appeared that the governor scolded the legislature that they rammed too many bills through without public input. What's your thoughts on that? Do you think that happened?
I don't think it didn't happen a lot. There were a couple of them. You know, sometimes when you get down to the end of the session and you've had committee meetings, once in a while, it happens that last few days where somebody feels like, hey, this needs to be changed in this bill. And so they'll do a substitute on the floor of either the Senate or the House that passes and it goes to the other side to concur it. It's concurred. But it may make sometimes a pretty significant change and didn't get a lot of public input. I know the one I know of that there were some people that were a little upset about was the wildlife bill. And on the last day, a senator substituted. I mean, cougars are causing a problem with our wildlife, you know, with our deer population. There's too many of them. There was a substitute made to change to where cougars could be hunted year-round with just a hunting license and trapped. And that's stepping way away from it. So I know there were some people, a lot of the houndsmen and people were upset about, we didn't have any public input. We couldn't come to a committee and testify. And I understand that. And I think you got to be careful about those types of things, honestly. So,
thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it. I really appreciate that. Representative
Jackson, the other one. Yeah, sure. And also, don't forget you have Senator Ibsen online.
Yeah.
And
maybe do the ones online so that they want to wall drop off, they could.
Senator Ibsen, maybe we can hear from you now.
Thank you. You know, I think we had a good session, all in all. The relationship between the House and the Senate, the relationship with the legislature as a whole with the governor, I think was particularly the budget system, which I worked a lot with, really worked well. We got to consensus fairly early, and there weren't a lot of changes to things that we had agreed upon as it went through. And I think Southern Utah did really well with money that was appropriated in the budget. Pleased with that. I ran one bill that I think is a great bill for law enforcement, which is a scholarship bill. It was actually started by Senator Karen Maine, and she had to resign for health reasons from the legislature after the first of the year. I was lucky enough to get that bill. She turned it over to me. What it does is it allows, you know, with law enforcement, between the ages of 18 when they graduate from high school and when they're turn 21 when you're eligible for law enforcement, there's a disconnect. And in last year's session, Senator Maine ran a bill that allowed 18, 19-year-olds to work in law enforcement, not in a sworn position, but in law enforcement as a support team. And that helped. What this does is allows them, it gives them a scholarship to attend a police academy either at the university or a post, and they will be able to get their credentials by the time they're 21, and I think that's a great thing. Actually, the scholarship wound up being named after Karen May. But I think, by and large, the session as a whole, I think we accomplished a lot and a lot of good things. A lot of chatter about the number of bills that were run. You know, I think we passed 575 bills. No, those are not all new bills or new laws that we have to live by. Some of that, it takes a bill to take away a law. So you got to kind of sort through that, take it where it is. I was a little surprised at the governor's letter that talked about nearly all of the bills had two Senate or House hearing, and one in each. As happens, the legislation that runs toward the end of the session doesn't have time to have either a second House or Senate hearing. And I think part of that's what he was referring to. Part of it is, like Representative Schiff talked about, is bills that are substituted at the last minute. Usually, you take a bill in the legislature that you see a fifth or sixth substitute, you know, a lot of eyes have been on that, a lot of negotiation have gone on to get it to that point. So, even though it was substituted, there was probably some kind of a committee that come with resolution that some kind of compromise. And then it still has to be voted on by all 104 members of the legislature. So, I feel like it's a good process, and I was pleased with the results of the session. I'm open for questions.
Don, hey, this is Burke Staley. School safety, you were like a co-sponsor of that bill. What do you hope to achieve from that? What are some of the main things you hope to achieve? I've been studying a little bit, kind of giving me that assignment.
Well, I hope that gives us the money to make our schools a safer place to be. Building-wise, money doesn't solve all problems. We know that, and we see that in our business. But I think that all in all, there was $75 million was the fiscal note on that bill to make school place safety safer and better. And I hope that each district and the school board as a whole will utilize that. And I think it was the intent of the legislature to make the money available to make the school place safety stronger and better. We keep having these mass shootings, and then our school resource officers are a big part of helping prevent that.
Thank you.
Senator Ibsen, this is Commissioner Taylor. I just have to thank you, because talking to you at the last minute, you really stepped up and helped Garfield County in our need. We just really appreciate you.
Well, I got some help and leadership. That money come out for Bryce Canyon Centennial Celebration was not ranked by committee, so I had to reach down and pull that up. But as we got 100,000, then we got 200,000, and we finally got the final request for 250. So it was a work for everybody working together.
Yeah, well, we just appreciate all of you. Appreciate what you do.
Anyone else have a question for Senator Ibsen?
Done off easy. I apologize for not being there in person, but I had some personal matters with getting people to the doctor today, so it wasn't possible. So I appreciate you being able to let me Zoom.
Thank you. We appreciate you. Maybe we could hear from Representative Brooks now.
Okay. Well, thank you for allowing us to be here and participate via Zoom, because there's so many conflicts I had to go through, and this allowed me to kind of jump between meetings and be here, so thank you for that. I thought this session was really great. We did a lot of things I thought were positive, and some were carryover from last year. I was the chair over last interim over Utah Retirement System, so that is a lot of work for a little bit of change. The chair over cannabis, which has kind of changed the way that we govern it, to make sure that the legislature is not always has to make every little decision. So we created a governing board that works with the health departments and the Department of Ag and police officers and advocates. What we're finding is that sometimes a government department causes more problems than they can help. And so we kind of pulled back some of the authority away from the health department and the Department of Ag and put in this governance committee so we got more eyes onto it and make sure that it's responsive to what we need and within the law. Some of the things we worked really hard on for the last years, and Senator Ipsen is a key component of this, was the removing tax off Social Security. We got another chunk moved away from that, so that's been about 4 years in a row now that we've been able to whittle away from the tax off Social Security. This year, we finally got the vaccine passport prohibition on the books, so it doesn't require you to show your papers everywhere you go in the state of Utah. But one of the things that, you know, we talk about, and Don Ipsen kind of said this, it takes a team. You know, sometimes we get to sponsor a bill and we kind of be that champion, but no one person gets anything done. There was a domestic violence bill, it's HB 199, that is a great bill, or the intent of it, but it was a kind of a disaster in the making, because we do have a problem in every state with some domestic violence. The issue really is if there's been a conflict, and let's say the husband has caused the pain to a spouse, and he goes to jail, he gets out, and there's about 7 to 10 days, sometimes up to 20 days, where he doesn't meet a judge, and in that time, you have a person who's now extremely elevated in frustration here, whatever else, and can cause more damage. In fact, we've seen some deaths caused from it. So the bill that came through was trying to restrict gun owners that have been arrested for domestic violence, but there's no due process in that. So how do we balance the two? And so I created a substitute, and I know Representative Jack and Chip and others have helped with that as well, where we made sure that if an officer was arresting for a domestic violence, that there was evidence of a crime, that individual went right in front of a judge immediately. Because we do have judges on call that are needed for a warrant. So this type of situation, they're put right in front of a judge to go through that due process to see if they really are a violent offender that's going to cause more crime before you remove someone's rights away. And that was something I thought was both balancing domestic violence issues, helping someone in a situation, but also making sure that due process is always part of that. So there's a lot of things that we were able to participate in rather than just the bills that we sponsor. And this was a great, we did a lot of great things. I think every single legislator from Southern Utah carried some type of appropriation to try to help. All of them, I believe, got through. And I think this was a great system that we worked with everybody. And of course, there's conflicts. But to what Representative Shipp was talking about in the governor's letter, I would kind of disagree a little bit. I heard some flack from some big bills that we typically in years past would hold to the very end of the session and then vote on them. And we moved them out earlier. Well, it wasn't that it got rushed through. It still went through the same process where they were heard in both committees in the House and the Senate, on the floor in both the House, Senate, and passed. But they were shocked that we moved them through the first few weeks of the session, and I thought that was great because it took a lot of that pressure from those big ones out of the way so we can work on other things as well, but they still got the same visibility. But there is a concern, I think Rex Shipp mentioned that, about when something's substituted at the last minute. But again, Senator Ipsen was dead on. I had bills that have been substituted over and over again. It's because you're involving all stakeholders, and a lot of those include advocates from just the regular public citizen. So there are opportunities we can always get it better, but this session I thought was a really good one and had a lot of public input. Thank you for letting me be here today.
Yeah, thank you for adding that nuance into the conversation. And did anyone have questions for Representative Brooks? Okay, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you, yeah. Thank you for meeting.
Is Representative Ellison still on? Oh, great, there he is. Hi.
Yeah, I'm there. Hi there. And kudos to you guys letting us do this via Zoom. I meant to be there also in person. I apologize, but I agree with what's been said. I thought this was a great session. This being my first session, it was very educational, but it was very powerful. There was a lot of good done. I'm super excited about the tax cuts. I hope that's just the beginning. As you probably are all aware, roughly about $850 million of tax cuts total coming into the state from various areas, and so I'm pretty excited about that because that's one of my big things is I want to see us reduce taxes significantly in the state of Utah. So that was a big one. I'm very proud of those ESG bills that was mentioned before, and I need to give some kudos to Representative Shipp. What he didn't say was he really has been the one that's been pushing that transgender reassignment surgery topic for the last several years, even though the Senate bill was the one that passed, but you know, Rex Shipp did a ton of work to make sure that got done, and so don't let him off easy saying that he wasn't a big proponent on that, because he definitely was. So one of the things that I was kind of excited about, we passed it. So the Education Committee, which is what I serve on, they were redoing the board of the board for the higher ed. In the bill, and they were going to be going from about an 18-member board for higher education down to about a 10-member board, one of which is a student. And both Representative Walter and I on that committee were concerned about rural Utah being represented in that board, and they said, well, of course, Governor always has the ability to choose who he wants to be on that board, and we just felt it was important. So I was able to get a floor amendment put into that bill to where one of those nine individuals does have to be by law from rural Utah. And so we felt it was important that rural Utah is represented. Sometimes I feel like the Wasatch Front wants to kind of run things when it comes to higher ed and a few other things, and so we just felt that was important to get that in there. So that was amended and it was passed, and so one of those nine members will be from rural Utah, so I'm excited about that prospect. So as far as a bill that I ran, there was a couple. I only did two bills. Both of them passed unanimously in the House and Senate, and the governor signed both of them. But the one was specific to my district, and you may have heard a little bit about it, but it was one where our local fire district, the Hurricane Fire District, was running into some challenges in terms of truth in taxation. They hadn't been raising any property taxes for the last 10, 12 years, and so they tried to raise some taxes all at once, and it did not go well. Nobody wants to see their property taxes go up that significantly. And so they came to me and said, hey, can we look at TRT? Can we look at another option? And so we looked at the sales tax option. And we ended up running the bill on a sales tax option. And what it does is it gives the ability for now Washington County, any county of the third through the sixth class already has this in law, but Washington County, being a second class county, does not have this ability. But in a third through sixth class county, and now Washington County, you have the ability to impose a sales tax to help with emergency medical services. And so the bill was crafted to be a second-class county with a national park and two state parks within her. So that basically meant Washington County. And the big reason why was because, you know, Utah, we've done such a great job of marketing the Mighty Five, but the rural communities were the ones having to pay for all the medical services and fire services and all these additional costs that come. And not that we're complaining, because it does help our economy, but there are additional expenses that come when it comes to search and rescue, when it comes to medical services and fire services. And so this bill was passed, and what it does, it was crafted so that any subdivision within a county, so it can be a special services district or it can be a city, a municipality, can impose a sales tax within that geographic area. And then those dollars can be used to help pay for emergency medical services. And so in the case of the Hurricane Fire District, they're looking to eliminate the property tax for fire and medical services and go strictly to a sales tax. And the average household in eastern Washington County would go from about $250 of property tax to cover those expenses to about $145. So it'll be a tax savings to the average household. But now the tourists will actually help contribute to that expense because they're adding to that expense. And so that did get passed, and so any municipality within Washington County has the ability to do that, but it does have to go to the vote of the people. And so hopefully this fall, they'll have all the wrinkles all ironed out to where they can have it on the ballot this fall to vote on that for Eastern Washington County. But St. George City, Santa Clara, any of those cities can opt into that as well. So that was one that I was glad we got done and just gave them a tool to be able to find a different way to help fund those types of services. And then lastly, just one that I thought was pretty powerful, even though it seems simple and it shouldn't be, probably you wondered why it wasn't, but the fact that we got the office of a sheriff in the state of Utah to be now a constitutional office, and it was not a constitutional office before, and so we were able to get that as well. So yeah. Those are kind of some of the highlights for me, and of course, open any questions that you might have.
Anyone have questions? Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Happy to be here.
No,
all right, no problem. Senator Hinkins came in too.
Yay!
So don't overlook him.
I need eyes in the back of my head.
Yeah. Here. So I'm Colin Jack, and I represent District 73 here in the state, which is in Washington County. There's four of us now from Washington County. You heard from Walt, or Representative Brooks, and Representative Elison, and Representative Walters is here, and I'm here. So you got all four of us from Washington County. We talked about the tax cuts, which was epic. Prior to this session, the largest tax cut was like $200 million, and we went to $850 million. So that's a huge jump, while still funding, by the way, $29 billion in our budget, and a lot of that goes to infrastructure and big projects that will help us go into the future. So maybe some of the projects that I worked on in the session, some of you may or may not know, I'm an electrical engineer, and I'm a power engineer, so I'm the chief operating officer for Dixie Power, and I'm also, in fact, my morning was spent with what we call the Southwest Utah Technical Task Force, where I chair a committee of all of the transmission owning power companies in Washington County. There's six of us distribution companies and three transmission companies. We all own transmission systems that interconnect. And then how do we make sure that between the nine of us, we're looking forward to the future to keep the lights on? Because power projects take 5 to 10 years to get permitted and built. And that's not getting better, that's getting worse. So we coordinate those projects together. So electricity is a big deal to me, and so one of the bills that I sponsored was HB 389, and it dealt with power delivery quality, and so nobody knows much what that means, but in the power sector, in fact, here in the Western United States, we have a Western Electricity Coordinating Council whose job it is to coordinate with all the power companies here in the Western United States and make sure that we're the most reliable possible. And in a meeting that I had with them a couple of weeks ago as part of the Utah Grid Reliability Committee, we asked them what are their top concerns for keeping the lights on. They listed four. And their top concerns were cybersecurity and sabotage, and was extreme weather events, resource adequacy, and intermittent resources and loads. Those were their top four concerns. And I wrote those down, and as I thought about that, I thought, this year, the state legislature, back in January and February, we passed four bills, major bills, to do with energy, and actually our four bills covered those four topics. So, coincidentally, right, we had Representative Albrecht, who's not here but probably would have liked to be. He had a bill that made it now a felony, therefore a prosecutable offense, to sabotage any critical infrastructure, power substations, telephone, water, sewer, any of that is now a felony. We had Representative Ivory pass the bill directly related to power supply, and so working to make sure that Utah pushes back against the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, in their ozone transport rule, the OTR, in which the EPA proposes to shut down all of the power plants in Utah, which we are opposed to, both as a state legislature and as a power company. Representative Moss had a bill to do with power resource planning, which deals with things like extreme weather events. And my bill that I told you about, 389, power delivery quality, deals with intermittent resources, which cause, and by the way, Senator Hinkins was my co-sponsor. He carried the bill through the Senate. I carried it through the House. But that helps to make sure that as the grid now takes all kinds of loads and all kinds of resources, that resources who are not traditional and not adequate for interconnection have to condition their power quality to the level that they don't damage equipment downline. Because we're seeing that here in Iron County, we're seeing it in Miller County, they're seeing it up north, where customer equipment, whether it's substation equipment or irrigation equipment, are being damaged because of the kind of resources coming online. So that power sector was one that I was very involved in. Like Representative Brooks said, sometimes the bills that don't have your name on, you spend a lot of time with. But one of those bills was one I was sponsoring. I also co-sponsored a bill with Senator Ipsen, where we helped deal with some of the bloat in prices. Maybe one of the worst offenders is airline prices, right? You buy a plane ticket and you think you bought it for this, but it's really that. By the time you get all the fees in, the same when you get a hotel room, you think you got it for this, but it's really that. And the same, our bill dealt with automobile purchase price. So that was HB 194. And also Senator Owens helped me with a bill to make it a felony for people to come in and steal copper out of power substations, lighting circuits, rock crushers, mining operations, where we're having a real wave, a crime wave of people coming in and stealing copper wire, which is only a misdemeanor because the value, the scrap value of the metal is $100, $200, but the damage is in thousands and thousands of dollars. And then the other one that I worked on with my co-sponsor was Senator Evan Vickers. By the way, he sends his regrets. He wanted to be here, but he got called into a last-minute meeting. So he helped us with a bill that didn't make it all the way out, but that was giving parents notification if a state entity permitted an adult-oriented event in a public space. So power and some other things. Those were where I spent my session. I don't know if anybody has any questions. That was a lot of stuff, and I tried to talk as fast as I could. Yes?
Representative, I appreciate you bringing up the power plant issue. You know, Colorado's complaining about pollution from our state, and I think it's more wildfires from California, from forest management, drifting through our state to theirs. I'm furious. I think tearing down the coal fire plant in Page was a travesty. I think you guys need to tell the federal government, Colorado, that we're going to surround our power plants with the National Guard and leave us alone. I think it's. I sold my cabinet shop to my son, and he needs lots of power to build cabinets.
Absolutely.
And we can't afford brownouts. We can't be like California. I know Rocky Mountain said they're going to, you know, they're not going to even entertain that until they get some baseload power like nuclear, which is great. But I hope that we make a really hard stand against the Colorado, the federal government, whoever wants to shut down our coal-fired power plants.
Absolutely, 100% agree. Just for the rest of you who may not have heard all the details, well, I won't tell you all the details, but one detail, we talked about Colorado. Denver, downtown Denver, has a smog problem, right? They are out of compliance with ozone, which is a component of smog. And so they extrapolated, right? They measured ozone problem in Denver. They extrapolated, well, it's not our automobiles. It's not our power plant right upwind from us. And it's not wildfires from California. And it's not even that big cloud of smoke that comes over from China that you can see on satellite photos. It has to be the power plant in Utah, which is the other side of the power plant in Colorado, but it's Republican power and not Colorado power. So we've got to shut those down. And yes, this bill 425 says that the, so, you know, it was discussed, does the Utah National Guard engage with the federal army? Or before then, we put the Utah Attorney General on notice that we expected him to sue the federal government. Of course, utilities are in the process of suing the EPA. Now the state of Utah is suing the EPA, and we even allocated funding to fund the lawsuit. So that's where we're at. The utilities are pushing back, but also the state of Utah is pushing back.
I have a comment, a question. The comment was, how did they measure the recreational smoke in Colorado? That's probably half the ozone in the state.
That's Walt
that,
Brooks.
That was like a comment.
Brooks committee.
No, those guys were doing the hotboxing.
So I learned that joking from Hilarion Conquist. He's a master of that.
Yeah,
the real question is, now you talked about a felony for taking wire out of power lines, and they even took them out of like the big overhead freeway lights and stuff like that.
Yeah, freeway lights.
What is the legislature going to do about catalytic converters so that you cannot, as an individual, take that to a recycle place, make it so you have to only have it done through a service place, or you have to take it to a police station or something? I mean, there's got to be some way that catalytic converter theft cannot take place in Utah. But they're taking them out of state, obviously.
Yeah.
Too, so, but.
So excellent question. And catalytic converters, they actually dealt with last session in 22 and dealt with several of those items you talked about and also made it a felony and made it so the individuals can't bring them in and you have to be a licensed whatever automobile thing, recycler to bring those in, those sort of things. And in fact, I based the copper theft bill on the catalytic converter bill to say, well, if you did that for catalytic converters, we should do the same thing with copper wire.
I guess the problem is they're still stealing it.
They are still doing it.
There was a story on last night about that. Yeah. The person came out and it was gone. It was taking another cart.
Oh, yeah.
But they're taking them out of state, which you have no jurisdiction over.
Yeah.
Maybe there needs to be a federal law that says, you know, transporting catalytic converters more than one across state line is a federal felony. I don't know.
Well, in fact, the catalytic converter ring they busted after the law that they passed last year was an international group. Like out of Serbia or something, and they had a whole container load of catalytic converters ready to go. Anything else?
Thank you so much
Thanks.
For being here.
It's great to be with all of you today. Thanks for having me. My name is Neil Walter, and I represent House District 74, which is the very west side of Washington County, Santa Clara, Ivins, and parts of St. George. So I have the good fortune of being pinned in this particular conversation between the entertaining Colin Jack, who I've known for a long time, and the distinguished Senator Hinkins, who I'm excited to hear from. So, I wanted to talk about a couple of specific things. There were a lot of things happening this session. Budget was a big deal. There were a number of issues that were really important. But I want to talk about three specific things. The first one is, if I were just to characterize some of the theme for 2023, and this was my first session, I think one of the themes that I saw was a really significant effort to focus on and communicate what have been long-standing historic Utah values. And what we're seeing is a lot of pressure from a lot of places all across the country to try and force us to move or shift. And I think this session you saw a really strong push back against that. And so if you look in a lot of different categories, you're going to see that there was an effort to say, these are the principles under which we think that we should be governing ourselves, and these are the principles under which we're trying to do the right thing for the citizens of the state of Utah. And you saw policy, you saw bills that were very much aligned with those principles. I want to talk about two other items. The second one is social services. So I served on the Social Services Appropriations Committee. And in all of our budgets, we had significant increases this last year. And there's reasons for that, and we could have a very long discussion about that. But one of the things I think that we have to be aware of and we have to be mindful about, specifically as it relates to social services, which impacts all of our counties and all of our communities, is number one, we have people who are genuinely and significantly in need in our communities. And there's tremendous efforts at many different levels, both the governmental and non-governmental and community, to try and help support individuals. In that context, our social services budget is the largest line item in state budget, and it's also growing faster than most of the other line items. And that's going to be a challenge for us. And I think one of the things that we're going to have to really work and figure out together, and this is going to be a long-term challenging conversation for us, is how do we provide the right level of support without falling into the trap that some of our other neighbor states and frankly our federal government have fallen into, where entitlements and support services now are crowding out all of the other important things that government is really supposed to do, right? And so I just want to make you aware and point out one of the things I spent a lot of time, I spent 3 weeks in the first part of the session looking at different components of, for example, the governor's proposal as it related to social services. And we will always be in this place where there is more requests than there is resources. And figuring out how to really prioritize and deliver the services that are the most impactful. And in my view, getting those resources, instead of being administered significantly at a state level, as much as we can, getting them to our counties and getting them to the local level where they can be distributed. I think that that's actually a good principle that can help us going forward. But I just want to put that out there and let you know, I think this is going to be a challenge that we're going to be wrestling with for a long time, because we're dealing with the law of large numbers. This is the largest line item in the state budget, and it is growing very, very fast. And so I think we're talking like 12 or 13% compound annual growth rate over the last 5 years. It's a very fast-growing line item. Okay. So I think it's something for all of us that we're all engaged in, we all have interest in. The last one that I wanted to mention, and I think that, again, this is going to be a really, really important issue that is going to continue to evolve, and there's going to be a lot of debate around, and that is education. I'm a firm believer that our future is really a reflection of our willingness to make the right kinds of investments in human capital. We have lots of resources in our state. We have natural resources, we have financial capital, but the most valuable resources by any measure are the people of our state, and our future will be determined by our approach to education going forward. And so a couple of things I wanted to comment about education that I think this year were very interesting. The first one was we did have a very large number of public education bills. And one of the things that I spent a lot of time at least trying to think through in my own frame was maybe many of these were good ideas, but I think it's a very fair question to ask, is now the right time? And I think that that's an important question sometimes. When we have a lot of good things happening, we can't do everything all at once. And I think that there was some need and effort to really try and consolidate around some of those bills that would be focused. And I'll give you a simple example that illustrates the point. We had three graduation attire bills, right? We needed one. And it took work to try and get those to a place where we had one and we could focus on a policy as opposed to multiple competing policies. And that naturally happens. That was a learning experience for me watching that in the legislative session, watching how that tends to naturally happen. But it does take work and effort to say, hey, we have a couple of different people working on in some way or another, some shape or another, the same idea. And let's talk about how we're going to get to the most important parts of that policy. I want to talk about one other thing as it relates to education, and this is maybe a higher level thought as opposed to a specific bill or a specific issue that came up. But I've spent 12 years in serving on charter school boards, and I spent 9 years teaching either part-time or adjunct in higher ed. And so I've had a little bit of time to think about public education, not as much time as some in the room, and I don't have the expertise and knowledge as some of you in the room do. But as I've thought about this, and I've thought about where is the movement nationwide going that's being, you're seeing a lot of movement in Florida and Arizona and other states, and what are parents in the state of Utah saying? And one of the things that I think that we're hearing is we want schools to be schools of choice. And what I mean by that is I want to go to my local school because I feel strongly about the quality educational experience that I'm having there, not because I have to attend that school. And we've come a long way in the last 20 years. If you think about it, it was more than 20 years ago that public charter schools were authorized in the state of Utah. I have been really impressed with some of the innovation that our districts have done in terms of dual immersion programs, STEM programs, CIT. I look at what our districts are doing, and I think there's some really extraordinary things. And I'm watching how families are saying, I'm really impressed with what an educator or a school community is doing in a particular place, and I want to be part of that. That's a great fit for my students, or for my student, or for my families. And I think that that's a really powerful dynamic. And one of the things that I'm really looking forward to, and I'm actually very interested to see, is how our school communities continue to innovate and find ways to serve needs. Now, this last year, the legislature appropriated $900 billion in new funds for education. It was a very large number. And over the past couple of years, it's been also very large increases. And I will say, based on my experience, again, I'm a freshman, first time, but I felt like there was a very, very strong commitment in the legislature to supporting from a funding side, institutions of public education, and a very strong commitment to that. But I also am very interested and excited to see the innovation that's happening as I look back over the last 20 years, at least that I've kind of got a perspective, and the amazing things that happen, and to think ahead about what we might be able to do in terms of providing really extraordinary educational opportunities to families and children. The last thing I wanted to just mention on the education front is I have tremendous respect for our educators, those people who are teachers, they're paraprofessionals, they're staff, who support our education community. I had a distinguished opportunity to be here with my German teacher, so there's Staley. So I learned how to sing loud in his class and a few other things. We had to get
can
to
sing good, sing loud.
So that's exactly what I told you that people many times. But I recognize, and I think we all, if we think back, we can see the impact for good the education professionals have on our communities. And I'm just a huge supporter and an advocate for the good that public education will continue to do and the critical role it plays in our economy. One just maybe smaller note on higher ed, and I don't want to diminish higher ed in any way, but one of the things that I also feel strongly about, and I think that there is a strong, very strong commitment to higher ed in the state of Utah, but one thought on higher ed. It's my personal view that higher ed really is the chief economic development engine in our state. And so there's a lot of things we can do from an economic development context, you know, in terms of trying to provide a good, a very qualified set of rules, a known set of rules and conditions under which people operate, a friendly tax environment, you know, a friendly state, a beautiful place. There's all these things we can do, incentives, etc. But the number one thing that attracts employers is workforce, right? The capability of a workforce. And so I think what I think our potential and opportunity in the future is to continue to really focus on the positive impacts from higher ed. And when I look at specifically higher ed, you can already see, but there's a, from the group of representatives and senators that represent these counties, there's a huge commitment to trying to support our institutions that are off the Wasatch Front, which are not only our technical colleges, but Utah Tech, SUU, and SNO. Right, there's a huge commitment to supporting that, because if we want to create economic development opportunities off the Wasatch Front, and frankly, rural Utah is the solution to many of the Wasatch Front's most challenging problems, traffic, air quality, etc. Right? If you want to see that economic development opportunity, it will come in proportion to the higher ed investment and the human capital opportunities that come out of those institutions. And so I realized today that maybe I spent a little bit more time talking about higher level things as opposed to specific bills. I think that was probably my biggest takeaway if I'm thinking about my experience as a freshman legislator, is just recognizing you have a lot of good people that are working very hard to try and support Utah values. We will have continued challenges that we'll be working through. One of those will be social services. And there is a tremendous commitment, and I think we're not going to get everything right every time, but there's a tremendous commitment to public education and the critical role it plays in the future of our state. So, anyway, thank you for having us here today. Yep.
Zemfili Dung, you know, and it could serve value.
You have a kind of idea.
That's just
I do not. Huh? You're gonna have to take that conversation behind you.
I just want to say to everyone, I want to say freshman team, but it was probably the best field that we've ever put out there of players that really did fight hard for us. Coleman, Joe, yourself, etc. But a question on Fife County, as you know, we're representing the health side of it as well, and we're getting some feelings and some concerns that they're not respecting Fife County's strength of bringing health care to remote areas, and that they're going to actually curtail our budget in a time when we have more money than ever, curtailing it to give it to individual counties to run their programs at our sacrifice, although we still have, in fact, in our five-county area, our population is growing. So our problem is getting worse and our funding is getting less. We want, because I know Neil to be one of the best statisticians, and he's the hound dog. He will find that last bit of information that will prove the point. Just to make you aware, this is happening as we're going, that the state health department is really, really causing us some huge concern.
I think I understand the concern. The resources, there's more resources, but they're accumulating at the state level, and they're not being distributed to the county level where you can actually help them get to the end of the road.
Yeah.
And I think that we're going to need your help just identifying where those constraints are so that we can try and help focus on maybe shine some light there.
Just consider in the back of your mind, WIC, it's a federal program, but state administers, then state divvies it up. The whole logic of the government is not that it's top down. So what do? We elect people at the local level to go up there and make sure that doesn't happen by bureaucrats. And so because we see that at DC, we're hoping that our legislators can fight for us in keeping our funding so that we can help mothers with children and other concerns that we have, because it's going to have to come back to our counties to fund those things when in reality the money is there to do it.
Great example. Thanks for bringing that one up.
That's it. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm new to this area. I'm David Hinkins. I live over in Barron, Utah, in Emory County, and I've been in the legislature. This is my 15th session, so I probably should be smarter than I am, but I've got these freshmen coming in know more about it than I do. But I represent Carbon, Emory, and Grand, San Juan, Wasatch, Utah, Kane, Wayne, and Garfield. So I got 9 counties that I represent, and one of the bills that I ran this time was, one of the bills I ran was for hydrogen production to be able to get a board of, we're going to get a, Director Todd, who's over our Department of Energy, is, we're needing some help on, there's a lot of federal grants out there, and we see California going to hydrogen a lot, and we see our power plant over at Delta going to burn part B hydrogen. Hopefully, they're hoping to go to even more eventually, but, We really don't know a lot about it, the distribution or about the production of it, and so we're putting a board together. That's what the bills we ran this year, to try to get some knowledge put together in Utah so we don't make mistakes, and also we don't miss out on all the federal dollars that's being poured out among other states. We want to make sure we get our share of it. One of the other big bills that I ran was the Senate Bill 251, and it came about from the state assumes that everything run into the Great Salt Lake, all the water. And so they stipulated probably 80% of it doesn't. And so I was at our hearing up there a year ago when they passed that bill to meter all the cities and all the towns, the mayor of Paraguna, I promised her that I would try to get them exempted, which that's what Senate Bill 251 does, is exempts all the smaller rural areas of anything under 1,000 hookups. And they still have to meter their water, which they always have. I mean, the irrigation makes damn sure that you don't get any more water than you're entitled to in the cities, so you get your fair share. And we want to make sure that a lot of these little towns are exempted. It costs millions of dollars, like my little towns over in Emory County and stuff, they can afford to meter all of them. They're talking about up there like 3/4 and 1-inch lines, and in ours you get the option of 1.5 or 2-inch lines. Well, their meters are going to cost probably 10 times more than their little water meters, and so they're not even playing on the same playing field that we are, in my opinion. And so we've got that exempted, and I know it didn't get everybody, but we're working on it, and I didn't want to screw it up. Some of them came and says, well, up in there's some of them towns up around up on the Weber River and stuff, they said, well, we want to get exempted too, like Rockport and stuff, and some of the other ones, but they had over too many connections, so they're like 2,000 connections, and so but I told them I don't want to screw this up and lose my bill over that. I said, we'll try and do that next year before this mandated that they have to do this. We want to look out for as much, especially if it's not going to, they're talking about they're going to get more water in there by not using the water, and it seems to me it's just the opposite. You know, when you don't flood irrigate, all that water that was going there before, now all of a sudden you're sprinkling and saving out a lot of water. They're saying we've got to conserve our way out of it. Well, if you conserve, the water's never going to get there. And so you keep in your higher reservoirs, which this year is going to be a good year. God's taking care of it for them. The legislature damn sure wouldn't have. We put $200 million in this, and $100 million of that. I don't have much money, but $1 million we spent on this trying to solution with all the studies and all the surveys and all the other stuff, $40 million last year for meters and all that, and 200. And so I think it's unproductive myself, but I'm outnumbered in a lot of cases. I really appreciate working with legislators from down in this area. One of the good news is this last few days is that they're going to have an inland port here at the iron mine now, and so that'll really help for our mine over in Perilous. They're going to be losing their contracts with IPP pretty quickly, as well as a lot of our mines up where I work at. Now, my background is I own a company called Industrial Electric Motor Service and have been in business since 76. And so we've been repairing all the electric motors for all the coal mines, power plants, and agricultural things, all the big industrial motors and stuff. And so it's a big business for me. Of course, nuclear, we had word the other day that Rocky Mountain Power is going to, we produce about 2,000 megawatts of power in the valley there, and they're going to replace it with nuclear, the same thing they're doing at Pincarmer, Wyoming, with the nuclear plant. But it's going to be about half the size of what we produce. It's only going to be about 500 megawatts each, so they're going to make up the rest of it in solar panels and give that a shot. But the Hunter Power Plant was designated to be closed in 2042. But with this new plan that they have, they've submitted to EPA and whoever else, Department of Energy, basically has moved it to 2032 or 2033. So we've lost 10 years on our plant. The only caveat was that a nuclear plant has to be up and operational and running before they actually decommission the coal-fired power plants. And so...
Do you have any commentary on that?
What's that?
Do you have any commentary on that? I mean, do you think that's a positive?
Oh, stupid as hell, in my opinion, if that's a commentary.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we got the cleanest burning coal. I mean, I drive by that power plant every day, you know, when I'm around, and or two or three times a day. I mean, it's right, my farms are surrounded by it. And, you know, sulfuric acid actually helps me. We got so damn much alkali in every county, and it's actually productive to neutralize our soils there. And so, we've got, we're going to be shipping all our coal out of the country here quite shortly because, it's, you know, right now, Richmond, they've got, Wolverine has got about 2.5-3 more years of port life up in Richmond. They can still use Stockton, but they can only fill a barge half full to get it down through the draft of the river. And so we're looking at places like Ensenada, Mexico. We're looking at, just a lot of places in the Sea of Cortez. We're going to look at different places that the coal companies are looking to try to get an export market. Right now, the prices of coal is high enough that it's being shipped out of Louisiana and Houston. And so the Gentry coal is actually getting about $180 a ton for their coal right now to be shipped to different places like the Dominican Republic and stuff. Because everybody else, every other nation in the world can build a coal-fired power plant other than us.
We tear them down.
We're decommissioning them, and we want to make damn sure that we demission. We don't even sit there and say, let's wait 5 years to see how this works out.
China's building one a month.
Huh?
China's building one a month.
Yeah,
and then we're going solar, and we're buying all of our solar components from China. So how's that going to work?
Yeah, well, I've already told you my commentary. But I don't agree with any of it, really. So, like I said, we've got the cheapest power, and we spent $600 million on backhouses on the Hunter Power Plant. We're just as ratepayers. I mean, these things, there's 99.9% of particulates don't get out in the atmosphere. And like I said, Colorado, they brought up about their Hayden stations out there, the Craig station. I mean, them things are blowing right into Denver. They're right on the airway. I mean, we're not. I mean, maybe Deseret could be, but it's really not even produced enough that the smoke wouldn't even get there. It's such a small unit compared to the Craig station and the Hayden station. But I got a few other bills that I was trying to think what other ones are. Oh, I'll tell you the bill that I really liked didn't help Washington County, and we appreciate that. But Senator Owens had a Senate Bill 175, and that appropriated $40 million for B&C roads in our rural areas. So there's 23 counties that are really going to be capped. You know, that's going to really help them a lot. They'll all get about $1 million or $2 million for their roads this year, and it will be ongoing to smaller amounts. But it's still a big deal, and, you know, it's really good that the urban legislatures, they realize it's their people that's coming down and tearing our roads up 90% of the time. When they come down on the weekends, it's muddy, and they go out there and tear them out. Well, our counties have to go back through and redo it. it's not our people do it. They know enough to stay away. You know, they've been stuck enough that they know when to go and not to go. But so I think it's good that we're getting that for our cities. It's going to help a lot. And Senator Owens, that was like the best. I think the best bill that came out of the legislature for rural Utah for sure. So.
One last question. Didn't you have a beard last time I saw you?
I did, huh? Yeah. Well, we shared our sheep Sunday. That's the only time I could get a shear. It's hard to find. It's hard to get people to shear sheep anymore. So these people had to come out and do Shane. The only time they could do it Sunday. So, but yeah, I figured, well, they look so damn good. I should have done it myself.
Well, thank you, Senator.
We appreciate it.
Thank you to all of our delegation. I think that's everyone.
Yeah, that's
very good. Wonderful. That was really special to get to hear from everyone today. I think now we'll move to the state agency updates. If
Want to just go down the line?
I'm
going to
head back to St. George. I've got another meeting.
Okay. Thanks,
Congressional updates, that's what I want to hear. Right people, wrong words. Yes, you really are. I just said the wrong thing.
Can you come up to the front, because the people are at home can hear you better from the microphone. All
right.
Kate put you on the spot.
Yeah. whatever I miss, Cindy will get, right? So, Congressman Stewart continues to promote his social media bill. This is one that's tender to my heart. As spread awareness of the damage social media is doing on our children, just this morning he posted on Twitter that we have countless protections for our children in the physical world, car seats, seat belts, minimum age for drinking and driving, and more, but we don't have any for social media. The damage to Gen Z and social media is undeniable, so there are no protections in the digital world. Why are there no protections? The Congressman has been passionate about suicide prevention among members of the military, and when he first went to Congress, he went to work on mental health for that reason. And as he got the 988 suicide prevention number and the crisis hotline, which was really big, and we're very proud of him for that. But in looking at the data, he became alarmed that the rise in suicidal ideation was most marked among young people. He wondered why in the world, in this generation, so much susceptibility to anxiety, depression, and suicide. He stated that the primary answer was social media. It destroys young people's self-image, self-worth, especially young teenage girls, and we have the responsibility to protect them. He said, we've never had a generation this anxious, depressed, or vulnerable children. You can pinpoint the movement this began to change. It was actually 2012. When Facebook bought Instagram and they started advertising and marketing to 9, 10, 11, and 12 years old girls. And then the same group started marketing to young boys. So in essence, he has brought forth this social media bill. It targets children 15 years and younger. From my vantage point at this on the school board, which I share with Burke, we saw a suicide last week, and we always get these in our emails when we see that. This bill is very passionate to me, and we need to make sure that it goes forward. And if you have any issues or problems with that, please let us know how you think about it. I do think it's very important that Congressman is on it. And this should be a bipartisan bill equivalent to the 988. There are lots of people, even on the Democrat side, who are passionate about this. Spring runoff. The congressman has been, office has been watching spring runoff. We're really happy to think that it is not going to rain on the snow, which should bring it down gradually. And in Washington County, we're sad that we are not, and the congressman is helping to get Warner Valley Reservoir, Ash Creek Reservoir, and it's a shame that we don't have those now, because this spring runoff could help us instead of going down to Nevada. So a new thing that it's not new. Congressman Stewart and Senator Hatch years ago brought forth a bill to make Sand Mountain a permanent recreation area. And in talking with Zach Brenstrom from the Washington County Water District, we think that would be helpful with the OHV people that are having a little bit of trouble with our Warner Valley area, if we could get a public permanent recreational area for that area, which would mean we'd take two pieces of Sitla out of that and exchange them with BLM property. And we need some support from Five County, and love to hear from you on that. So my next and last, then you get to hear from Cindy. Congressman Stewart's office last year did a community project funding for Utah Tech University. They got funds for a new program that is a joint effort between IHC and UTU. This is called IHC. It's called Precision and Functional Genomics Center, and they are having their ribbon cutting and an open house Friday, April 14th, from 11 to 1 at the Science and Engineering and Technology Building. This is a great program. It will allow the genomics people in the hospital to have a program where they're training some techs to help them facilitate the program there. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just add two things. The congressman was in Kiev last week, and as his work on national security, and met with Zelensky, and made sure that he knew that we spend a lot of money there, and we can be supportive without keeping to write checks, and that some of that push should be back onto the EU rather than the US to fund that entirely. Also, we finished our work on appropriations, so those bills have been submitted to the bigger group. Those will be available on Monday on our website, so you will know if you are at least on the short list or not. Just because we have you on our list doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get approved, but we have a pretty good reputation for getting those done. And then just also because 'tis the season, we do a lot of casework on IRS, so if you get calls from people who are having a hard time, especially with crazy stuff with Social Security, IRS, all that, if you've got people in your communities that need help, call our office, but also any of the congressional district delegation has people working on that who can help get through some of that. If you can't get a hold, or you've got people in your communities that can't get a hold of IRS, Social Security, or passports. We've also had a lot of, people are traveling again. It's spring break, and a lot of people are having a hard time getting their passports. So if you've got those, reach out to our offices.
What about veterans?
Veterans, anything with a federal nexus, reach out to any of the congressional offices. We all have workers that can help with that, but we really are here to help work through some of that red tape.
That's great to know.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amy.
Yeah, very good.
The Senate has been in recess for the past 2 weeks, and so Senator Lee has taken the opportunity to go on a couple of different congressional delegation trips with some of his colleagues. A few weeks ago, he was in Mexico meeting with the president. That was a CODEL that was hosted by Senator Cornyn out of Texas, but it was a bipartisan group, and they got to talk to Mexican officials about border security, immigration. A lot of the conversation focused on fentanyl and the drug trade, and specifically China's growing influence in that area. So China is actually sending more and more of the ingredients that the cartels are using to make the fentanyl and the drugs that are ultimately ending up on our streets and our homes. So that was a big topic of discussion. And just this past week, Senator Lee joined another bipartisan CODEL in South America, discussing a lot of the same issues. Senator Lee has become a popular member on these Mexico and South America CODELs because he is fluent in Spanish. So he's able to take on a leadership role on those CODELs, and he's looking to be more involved in the border security discussions and the drug trafficking discussions. Talked a little bit about it earlier, especially Representative Jack, about the ozone transport rule, or the good neighbor rule as it's known. So that rule has been finalized, and if it does not get overturned, or if Utah and other states aren't successful in overturning that, our coal-fired power plants will be seriously put at risk. So Senator Lee is with this rule will affect about 24 states. So Senator Lee is working with senators from those other states to try to build momentum to try to get this thing overturned. The only problem there is, even if the Senate and Congress pass a resolution to overturn it, it has to be signed by the president. And this was President Biden's EPA that will put that. But out of this rule, it'd be very difficult to get a veto-proof majority. So state, especially the lawsuit that the AG's office is going to file, I know that the AG's office is working with a number of other states to get everyone on board to try to build a strong legal case against this rule. And then on top of that, just last week, the EPA announced that they were proposing even further restrictions on emissions coming out of coal-fired power plants, in addition to and above what was going to be imposed by this good neighbor authority. So it just keeps coming.
Heath, can you talk just a moment about that proposed monument that we're starting to hear stirrings about? Another 1.1 million acres.
Arizona, northern Arizona. It was proposed yesterday. Grijalva, and somebody wants... what they're trying to do is really lock up the uranium.
Yeah.
I believe. And then
on the Arizona Strip?
Yep.
Yeah.
So they're proposing they want Biden to make another monument.
Yeah, so the Obama administration put a 20 or 30 year moratorium on mining there.
30.
And then they've tried to get that withdrawal permanent through legislation. Grijalva's been unsuccessful. Senator Lee has been key in blocking that in ENR. And so now they're going to try to use the Antiquities Act to do it. And so the big question is going to be, where does Arizona's delegation stand? Because they've got two Democratic senators. And so if they're willing to oppose it, then it would be difficult for President Biden to use that to override two democratically elected senators. But that's one that's going to be close to what it's going to be.
They need to do away with the Antiquities Act.
It's got to go.
Yeah.
It needs to be run through Congress.
Yep.
Yeah. Or at least limited to like 2,000 acres or something, like
two
military, or 500 acres, a military base, like when they're closing an old historic base.
Yeah.
Let the president do those, but anything bigger than that, have it go through Congress. Then it's at least it's done for the people.
Senator Lee has tried just about every possible reform to the Antiquities Act, from scrapping it all together to just minor reforms, and that is viewed as a golden goose for these environmental groups and the Democratic members who benefit from it. So it's very difficult to get political support to change the Antiquities Act.
Except Wyoming and Alaska got a specific exemption from that.
Yeah, and Utah has suffered far more than either of those states, so we should be entitled to the same thing. Another concern, I'm just the bearer of bad news today, you have the state legislators come and give you the good news, and now the federal delegation gets to do the bad news. The BLM proposed a rule that would put conservation on the same level as recreation, grazing, mining, all the other uses in BLM's multiple use mandate. The BLM's new rule would put conservation on par with everything else. So basically, they're saying non-use.
30-30.
Yeah, non-use should count as multiple use. So that's another thing that Senator
Lock it
up. Yep, lock it all up. If anyone's interested, the BLM Canyon Country office is looking for an artist in residence for the fall. Commissioner Taylor, you want to go paint some pictures for BLM? Put your application in.
Can you get on that? It'll be colorful.
Colorful words. We've already heard some colorful words today from one of the representatives here.
Yeah, that's exactly what he thinks. That's about all I've got for an update, but many of you have already heard this will be the last time that I get to update you as Senator Lee, Southern Utah Director.
Ooh. Who actually knifed us in the back?
I'll have to talk to Commissioner Holquist about
that. Okay.
I won't be going too far. I'm just going to work for Washington County. You won't be rid of me yet. I'll be seeing you around, but just in a different capacity. So
we wish you well.
It has been wonderful working with you all over the past few years.
So true.
Thank you. Heath and I were discussing my plans to apply for the artists in residence, but I was thinking more of like interpretive dance. And Commissioner Olmquist, I don't know about you, but all this talk about catalytic converters is exhausting.
I can't believe you didn't get that one.
I just have to ask him what he smoked.
Okay, so more bad news from the federal delegation. Medicare and Social Security trustees say that Medicare will start or will be insolvent by 2031, and Social Security will start cutting benefits by 34. Just kind of tease up the Trust Act that we ran through the last Congress and hopefully provide some momentum for us to get traction on that in this current session. To echo Heath's concerns about the BLM's draft rule, it's bad news. There's no way to spin it. There's no perspective from which you can look at it that says anything good comes of it, because conservation can mean so many different things to so many different people. It's just going to be a stick to beat us with. And I know that public comments don't make or break those policies in and of themselves, but we routinely get our butts kicked in the comment periods on these types of things. So I suppose this is my plea to you good people to get with your folks and push back during this comment period with some intelligent, articulate reasons why this is garbage. In other news, the Waters of the U.S. Congressional Review Act made it through both chambers. The president obviously vetoed it. The House, kind of as a side note, the four Democrats who flipped were our friends of the boss, guys and gals that he goes to dinner with every month. So I think that's a pretty neat thing to note. But the House has an appetite for a veto override vote. Whether or not that can actually happen is frankly, it's not likely, and it's not likely to be taken up in the Senate either. But we're still watching the Sackett case, and we'll push back every chance we can against the WOTUS rule. Both the Obama administrations, one is in Supreme Court and Biden administrations. The FSA has a new drought relief program for livestock producers. Should any of your constituents need that, don't hesitate to talk to me or contact the FSA offices. Those folks are still learning about that program because Secretary Vilsack rolled that out about a week and a half ago. So it's still in the wee stages. But that should hopefully provide some relief to livestock producers who have suffered with drought-related issues and now flooding.
How retroactive is it?
That's a very good question. I don't even think the folks in the FSA office know the ins and outs of it quite yet. And the state executive director, likewise, is still trying to get up to speed. If I'm being frank, I wouldn't be surprised if Secretary Vilsack doesn't know the ins and outs of it. But there are some options there, and I'll try to keep you guys up to speed as that develops. So with Senator Braun, Senator Romney is co-sponsoring the IRS Act it's an act that addresses the blatant abuse of power, specifically during the Obama administration. We're seeing that again as well. The IRS targeted NGOs that were related to conservative groups really unambiguously, unapologetically went after those folks. And so we're hoping this piece of legislation will curtail their ability to do that going forward. And lastly, the entire delegation is asking Secretary Blinken for a passport office here in Utah. Given the number of missionaries and Hill Air Force Base and the business community, sending all of our problems to Denver is A, a bad idea, and B, they're just not capable of keeping up with it if you've been following them lately. So those are things we're working on. Does anybody have any questions?
Will that be in Fillmore?
Yeah, I hope so.
Escalante.
Central. No, you can't get it. You won't be able to dissolve there.
Yeah.
That would be the problem. Well, I appreciate you guys.
Good job, Kyle.
Thank you, Kyle. Okay, if I'm not ahead of myself, then now is there anyone here from the state agencies to provide updates?
Let's see who's online. NPM. I don't know who RX Tracks is. Does anybody know who that is?
No. Spy.
Who's on as RX Tracks on there?
Is that Senator Vickers?
No. That is me.
Oh, okay. We've got you on twice, that's why. Okay, that's fine. We just didn't know who that was. And I don't know who Patty is.
That's our
Oh, okay. Great, because I sent this out to every commissioner in Southwest Utah and every mayor that they could listen to the updates here, and didn't get a large response, but a few. Great. The opportunity.
You got a couple on.
Chris got it. He's at Dell. I'm doing something.
All right. And so we don't have anyone from the state agencies.
Now, normally, that's just the Workforce Services has been the only one that's been coming to me, but others like UDOT can come here if they want to. And
They're invited. And now the University and Technical College updates, and that's about 15 to 20 minutes total.
That's going to be a short one too. On here, Walton, not Walton.
Henry.
Henry said that he had a commitment, so he would not be able to be here. Okay. And they will now. Let me pull this up here, so I can let you all know on the one for SUU. And also, I do invite each month the other two colleges, the trade ones, to come here as well, but let me find it here.
For SUU?
For Southwest Tech and also for Dixie Tech that they're inviting. This is from Donna Law this morning. I've assumed a different role at SUU, and Stephen Lisenby asked if I would again pick up the steering committee as part of my community and government relations role. Am I remembering this is correct, the committee where you'd like to have higher ed updates? Thanks for your guidance. So I responded back to her yes, and the meeting was today, that we also had the Zoom meeting option. But so Donna Law will be coming in the future to represent SUU. The bylaws say it's the president of SUU and for now, Utah Technical College, that's hard to say, Dixie. But yeah. But the president or the president's designee, and so this is where it's filtered down to it. SUU now, it'll be gone a lot, instead of Stephen Lisenby. And that person is actually a member of this board, the committee here, but they're a non-voting member. Same with Walton is the same, so Henry Walton.
Okay, very good. So does anyone want to bring up any more local affairs that we haven't already talked about?
Gilwin's Temple, open. Is that on the agenda?
The next agenda.
Okay,
I'm sure.
That's your next agenda.
Sometime this fall. That's what I heard.
Do you want to bring up, since we're here, about the a little bit further to the health department issue, just so people are aware?
Just so those mayors and the representatives who are here, I brought that up with Legislator Walters for the one reason that, you okay?
Yes, I want you to talk loud.
Okay, talk higher.
Just loud.
So we are facing a situation where funding is diminishing, let's say, on the WIC opportunities that we've had in the past. All of the five counties have shared $1.2 million up to $1.4 at one point. Now, last year was $1 million. And then the legislature has been probably not as informed, because you could tell he didn't know much about it, but that the state health department, which you and I agree has way too much power, maybe others agree, over our local level, that they're saying, well, we're going to look at that again, and we're going to give you even less money to run the same or greater programs in our counties.
Because so, they're weighting it towards single county health departments.
Yeah.
And trying to, whether intentionally or unintentionally, focus the money on urban counties and it inadvertently or purposefully punishes multi-county association of government type of health departments that have combined urban and rural.
So since Washington County has a large population relative to everybody else, I feel like, even though Dr. Blodgett later told me it wasn't that case, but we can't help but think that because we're part of all of you, that we're being somewhat penalized.
Right.
So maybe they're not so smart as to think this at the state health level, and that is to say, well, good, then the shortfall that we have for the other four counties, Washington County can pay for that. And I don't know if that's really their goal, but they certainly don't appear to be doing that to Salt Lake County.
Yeah. So what we need to do in our messaging, I think, is to just make sure that our legislators and representatives are aware of the fact that this would have a detrimental impact if they're weighting things in order to punish either conglomerate public health departments or urban health departments.
And I would want to ask each of the commissioners here if I even said to Dr. Blodgett, I said, well, hey, then maybe Washington County backs out.
Right.
And we'll go it alone. And he said, none of these other commissioners or counties that I know of in Fife County would want to all of a sudden set up their own health departments.
No.
I think that's a dumb idea.
Yeah. So we think it would be easier for every little town and not little by population or importance, I'm just saying, you know, lower population, it would be easier for them to maybe have like a family dollar. And then it can serve as a health department too. Anyway, that's the gist of it, and I think that eventually we'll find out what's happening tomorrow, because that's when Dr. Blodgett has the meeting with them, and then if it goes bad, then we might have a combined letter and some help from legislators to turn that around. That's why I mentioned the word bureaucrat, because bureaucracies, because it seems like we have a lot of that.
Yes.
And I can't think of any commissioner in here or school board member or mayor who would say, I'm just going to turn it over to the Parks Department to make those decisions. I mean, no, it has to stop with the elected people, right? Mm-hmm. Right?
Or yes, absolutely.
I do have one complaint.
Another one?
To Gary. Another one. Is the only.
Ben's got to be involved here.
You are involved. We're quite conservative. I believe most of us would generally think that in Utah we're conservative and that we think that way. Every Twix over there had was the left Twix. I looked through every one of them. Now, when you're buying, we want some
mine right Twix.
On the way up here, we ate all the ripe ones. And that's all that was left.
All right.
Well, luckily,
that's it.
Good to hear. Hey, I'm wondering.
I'm on it.
Shut it down.
Hey, wait.